See, we communicate with squirms. So I knew what that squirm meant from Michael. Zen stories are kind of great, don't you think? I mean, that's a lot of what we like about the Zen tradition. It's full of good stories, and they punctuate the long, boring hours in a nice way of Zen practice. And I used to think Zen stories, like, you know, they come across sometimes as pretty exotic, you know, and sort of amazing and surprising. But I've gradually come to realize that if you just sort of, you know, hang around and practice long enough, or just live long enough, whether you call it Zen practice or not, we all have Zen stories. Or maybe we all are Zen stories in the end. And so Kate said a little bit about our collective history. And so, yeah, I was remembering that I first started practicing. I sort of stumbled into practice as a young man, as a teenager, actually, and then through undergraduate and college, and I spent some residential time living at one of the San Francisco Zen Center places in California. And, you know, it was kind of like this, I didn't know really what it was or what I was doing, but it just had a feeling to it. You know, it felt important. It felt like it was somehow helping me have a sort of broader sense of, you know, who I am or what I am. But I also found it, like, kind of difficult. Do you find this kind of difficult? Like, it's hard to sit there. And it's not like the first thing I think of when I wake up. Like, oh, great, I'm awake. Now I can do Zazen practice. That's really good. I think of a lot of other things that I could do. And I have to, like, convince myself that actually the day will be better. It'll be good for me. It'll be good for everybody I encounter today if I practice, even though that part of my mind that gets interested in doing things is not interested. And so that was pretty clear to me when I first started, you know, that you need support, I need support to keep this up. And when I graduated from undergrad and it was time to move on, leaving California, which was a very expensive place to live then and is now an astronomical place to live, and we were moving to Bellingham, Washington, a place I barely knew, I went to see Norman Fisher, whom Kate mentioned, maybe some of you have met, who was a teacher from California, who was instrumental in the end in both of these sanghas coming to be. Anyway, I went to see him and I said, basically, thanks a lot, I'm out, you know, because I'm going to this place called Bellingham, Washington, where there are no Zen, you know, practice places, and I don't know anybody really. I have my one high school friend there, but... I didn't think he'd be too into this. And so here's the Zen story part. So I went to say to the teacher to say, I'm done with practice, thanks, it's been great. And he said, Bellingham, Washington. Now, is that near Vancouver, Canada? And I said, yeah, it is. And he said, oh, I've been invited, you know, I might have the years a little bit off. I've been invited to go there and teach. Maybe you can come too. And so I did, you know, and we did, and here we all are, you know. So if Kristen Penn and Michelle Mills had not been to visit him a few years earlier, invite him to come to be a guest teacher at the Karuna Meditation Society, maybe none of this would have happened, right? But every one of us has some something where maybe none of this would have happened, right? So it's interesting, you know, we're in the middle of all kinds of Zen stories. They sound very impressive and cool later on, you know. If 20 or 25 years goes by, then they get good, or 1,000 years goes by, then they get really good. So we just have to wait a while, and all of our Zen stories will be studied by our distant siblings, or whatever you call it, our ancestors in the future. We'll be the ancestors, I guess. Yeah, did you hear about this time when there was a traffic jam on, you know, Canby, and, you know, the great teachings unfold? So anyway, lately in Bellingham, the group of us have been giving talks on one of the many wonderful Buddhist lists, the list of perfect practices for bodhisattvas. There are six of these practices. A Sanskrit word, paramita, is used. Some of you have heard of the six paramitas. Sometimes a list of 10 is given, but the six are most common. And this list of six, I think, is worth memorizing, actually. All these lists are worth memorizing, but there's so many of them, you know. And we're too busy to memorize things. But these six, I think, are worthwhile. They are the practices of generosity, ethical living, patience, energy, meditation, and wisdom. And the Sanskrit sounds really cool, and I was thinking about that. I think, you know, part of what attracts us to Zen is it seems very sort of practical, and you don't have to learn a bunch of weird sort of stuff, but the weird stuff is actually quite beautiful. So just listen to this. Don't try to remember this, and you can look it up on Wikipedia easily enough, you know. But just listen to how this sounds in Sanskrit, this list of six. It would be, I think, a good meditation object or something you could write and appreciate. Just these beautiful words from this other ancient language. Dana paramita, shila paramita, kshanti paramita, virya paramita, jnana paramita, prajna paramita. Isn't that nice? And the last one you maybe heard because it's in all kinds of little Zen transitional chants. Prajna paramita, the perfection of wisdom. So they all work together. Generosity, you know, and the decision to live in an ethical way, that's a generous act, right? And being ethical makes it more possible to be generous. Patience, I mean, that's a no-brainer. We certainly need patience. We certainly need energy. Meditation seems to help. And through all of this, supporting all of these practices so that we can do these in a sustainable, meaningful way, wisdom, how do we do all this? So anyway, we're on the third one now in our series, so I thought I'd talk a little bit about the third practice, Kshanti Paramita, patience, the practice of patience. So the word Kshanti means something like unaffected by or able to bear. And though it's most often translated as patience, it can also be translated as a tolerance or forbearance. And I think when we hear the word patience, we think about virtuous, patient people, like it's sort of a quality that somebody might have. You can be a patient person or an impatient person. And we want to be a patient person on a good day anyway. We think of patience and many of these qualities as sort of wired into our personality, into who we are. But I think what a great addition to that conversation Buddhism, and maybe especially Zen, brings is that's not necessarily a helpful way to think about it. Maybe a little bit limiting to think of these positive qualities, like patience, as personality traits that are more or less fixed. Maybe we can think of them in a more fluid and dynamic way as things that we practice and cultivate and develop. And so the word that they modified each of these practices with, so it was not just kshanti, not just patience, but patience paramita, like prajna paramita in the little chants, is kind of an unusual modifier, which helps us, I think, make this kind of little jump from patience as something that's fixed and static to patience as something that's dynamic and deep and worthy of curiosity and investigation. So paramita means something like perfection or going beyond. So perfection in the sense of beyond perfection and imperfection. So it's very Zen-like. So maybe the simplest way to think about it is a kind of a patience that's beyond our idea of patience. Not sort of limited by or clamped down on by a sort of limited view of perfectionism, but as something broader and something further than that. And patience beyond patience has, I think, a nice quality of movement, a dynamic feeling, like what is this kind of going beyond? Beyond what? To where? And so let's think for a moment about patience. Have you felt impatient recently? Today? Then the last 2 minutes? Yes? That's good. So we have plenty to practice with. And I think it's interesting when we think about patience in the way that we probably just thought about it, our minds tend to go first to me, right? To me, to mine, to me over here trying to be patient with you, you over there trying to be patient with me. Like, what's he saying? And there's a kind of sense of separation when we stand in the line at the post office, which we don't do as much anymore. I need a new example, but we mostly try to avoid that. But when we're practicing what we usually call patience, there's a sense of me over here being patient with them over there, being patient with their children, patient with their coworkers, patient with their job, patient with the traffic, that's it, patient with the traffic. And what I noticed when I tried to sort of sit down and reflect on this and think about patience, that's where my mind went too. Like, how could I sort of like think about how I manage to sometimes manage to be patient with some other thing that I don't like, and how could I say something that might help you to be patient with some other thing that you don't like that you sort of put up with, so that you don't, you know, so we don't kind of lash out or express our impatience or do something that we're going to regret or that will be harmful to somebody. What we are interested in here is something that's a little more helpful than that idea. That the mind goes so quickly to separation. Me, you, this, that, us, them. And there's a kind of limit to that, right? There's a kind of tightness to that. In that frame of me and you, there's only a sort of very provisional, fragile, you know, temporary kind of patience that's even possible before we revert to, like, I'm out of here, enough. And we're willing in that frame to be patient with things up to a point, right? We say things like, I'm out of patience, you know, I'm done with this, you know, you have pushed me too far, right? So what practice can bring is a sort of broader view where we're also turning towards that very deep habit of mind and heart, the habit of separation and division. And in patience beyond patience, we get interested in whether our patience practice can move us beyond that gap. And I think Zazen really helps us here, don't you think? When we sit down to practice, sometimes we can feel some space opening up. We can feel or ease our way into a wider view, a broader feeling of self and other, a self that includes others, others that include the self, a self that does not feel so separate, a self that instead of holding itself as strong and separate and trying to sort of self-consciously be patient, is able to merge with the situation, able to integrate, able to let go, able to allow, able to accept in a deep way that this is it, this is our life, this is our situation, this is this moment, this is what it is. And so meditation is on that list. So this list is very self-supporting. So the practice of meditation beyond meditation helps us to feel our way into a dimension of patience. And the sixth practice of wisdom helps us go even wider and any deeper. So all this might be a way of thinking about self or this confusing Buddhist idea of not self. Can we be truly patient as a separate self? Or is something else required? Not that we won't always have some experience of a separate self, of course we will, but maybe we can learn to lighten up. Maybe we can learn to dance with this personality, this history, these habitual frames of mind that just keep coming back and back and back and back. And for some reason I thought about fishing. And I'm not particularly a fisherman, like maybe when I was 10 my dad showed me once or something like that, but the idea of catch and release came to my mind. And as we're going along in any particular moment, are we the fish or are we the fisherman? The self catches us. We get hooked. And of course we're impatient. We got a hook stuck in us. things are not the way we'd like. Sometimes this desire for things to be different can be actually kind of virtuous in nature, which is also confusing. Like, we want to be patient with some things, but maybe there are things that we should not be patient with. We want justice. We're impatient with injustice. We want human institutions to stop kind of like ruining the entire planet. We want the madness in the Middle East to stop. But other times, our desire for things to be other than the way they are seem to be pretty selfish. And it's a little embarrassing. At times, we want people to like us. We want like a better office, a nicer car, a different assignment. Maybe if we get involved in the Zendo, we notice we have particular preferences about how things should be or shouldn't be here. We want our partner to clean up their piles. That's a common one in my mind. So we're these little fish, and we're being hooked by things that seem to be virtuous, seem to be sort of self-centered. And other times we're the fishermen. Oh, you poor little me. So tense, you know, so worried. I know you can relax a little more about that. I know you can accept that the only way forward is to accept things a little more and even appreciate things a little more. And we can gently sometimes, you know what I mean, pull that little hook right out of our desire and our separation and ease our little fish back into the water. Watch it swim away. So beautiful, you know, the way fish swim, isn't it? Just lovely. And maybe you studied our great sort of ancestor Dogen a little bit, and he liked this metaphor too, fishermen and fish and water. And it seems like it's hard for us to get unstuck from our self-focused point of view if we're just in our usual narrative. So sometimes some imagery is helpful, I think, right? Some new teaching, some new ideas. And so think about the last time you were really hooked by something. Like really hooked by something. What was that like? So really, just think about it for a minute. What was that like when you're really caught on something? Just, and what was it like, you know, when it finally released? When the hook finally came out? So how can we be deeply patient and tolerant and able to bear all of it with grace and connection? It's not so easy. And sometimes it is easy. We, at the back of our Zendo, we converted the back parking lot into a little Zen, kind of a Zen garden. It's pretty good, actually. Pretty nice. I'm often, when I'm there, I focus on the weeds and the volunteer issues, but it's actually really nice. And it's created a nice place for a homeless person to live, actually. So lately we've been having a kind of a drifting kind of person sleeping sometimes in our back garden. And so it's starting to become an interesting sort of question in the Sangha, like, well, what do we do about this? And I've noticed a real diversity of reactions in our Sangha members. Should be nice to him and kind of invite him in to some extent, or kind of shoo him away because, you know, like he shouldn't be there. It was not designed to be a place to sleep, right? One of our members said something like, this is private property, you shouldn't be here. And she reported that he was kind of rude to her. And he was kind of hanging around in the back yesterday morning, and the day before actually too. And at one point, he came inside, which he had not done so far. And he respectfully took his shoes off and was going around asking to talk to the priest. So eventually he got to me. And before even that could happen, there was already a miscommunication. He was wearing like lots of jewelry, like lots of rings and lots of different necklaces. And the first report I got that he was looking for me was that he wanted me to buy the jewelry. So I already was sort of predisposed to be sort of impatient. Like, oh no, you know, uh-oh. And then once he finally got to me, it turns out, no, he did not say the word buy. He said the word bless. He said the word bless. He had a special ring that he wanted me to bless. And he introduced himself, Josiah, turns out to be his name. And we talked a little bit about practice and about the symbolism of his different jewelry representing different spiritual traditions. I have to admit, my mind noticed that he was a little smelly, but very appropriate, very kind, very interested in practice and having a very particular vision of practice. So one of the other priests in our community and I quickly created a little blessing ceremony and offered incense and incensed the ring, and I said, I kind of made something up that I thought would be helpful to him. And I noticed some patience and impatience arising inside me, like a little impatient with myself. Was I really being sincere? Part of me wanted to just kind of make something up and get rid of him, right? That thought arose. Another part of me was really enjoying this, like, this is a beautiful moment with this person that a minute ago I was suspicious of and ready to guard my wallet or something. And then, after we blessed his special ring, he started telling me about a device that he had in his backpack that was made of special gems that is going to save the world. And the device is 90% done, and he's been designing it for quite a few years, and he wanted to tell me about it and show it to me, and also show me the manual he was writing. And then I realized I could practice patience and say no thank you, which I did. It was time to do something else. I said, no thank you. Maybe you can show me another time. And he left. And it was all fine. So it's interesting, isn't it? You know, sometimes we can merge with what's happening. Sometimes we resist. Sometimes we're trying to manage and control. Sometimes we're embracing and open. Sometimes we are truly with Josiah. Other times we want to call the police. So how can we find a way to practice patience that's sustainable, that's real? And the Buddhist teachings on patience go pretty far. So I want to mention just a few things there, and then we'll close. You know, I think our provisional idea of patience, as I mentioned, is sort of has some limits to it, you know. I'm willing to bless Josiah's ring, but not to see his device for saving the world. But there are passages in the traditional Buddhist teachings that suggest you should just always say yes. Just always allow. Just always practice patience, no matter what's happening. Even if it means giving up everything, give away the zendo. Give away the money. Give away everything. Here's some advice from the Prajnaparamita texts. A bodhisattva should not be afraid if he finds himself in a wilderness infested by robbers. For bodhisattvas take pleasure in the wholesome practice of renouncing their belongings. A bodhisattva must cast away even her body, and he must renounce all that is necessary for life itself. A bodhisattva should react to danger with the thought, oh, if these beings take away from me everything that is necessary for life, then let this be my gift. So generosity, right? If someone should rob me of my life, I will feel no ill will, anger, or fury on account of that, even against them. I would take no offensive action, either by body, voice, or mind. So it's a great pleasure to be robbed if you're a good bodhisattva. An opportunity to give, an opportunity to just completely let go. And there's another kind of graphic story, which I'm not going to quote for you, where the Buddha even delights in like his limbs being chopped off, you know, because these robbers seem to need to do that, so I'll gladly help them out. So that's not really how we think about patience. So we do have a kind of a meeting here going on between a sort of intense, deep view of patience, sort of beyond patience, letting go of everything, and a kind of Western view of, well, what's appropriate to give? What's helpful to give? I was reading an interesting book on these practices by the Buddhist scholar Dale Wright, and he points out how deeply conditioned we are by our Western tradition of thought. And, you know, one thing is that we don't want to be patient with injustice, right? We don't want to be patient with crime. We don't want to be patient with things that are truly harmful. We want to do something about them. And Dale Wright points out that maybe this goes right back to Aristotle. That Aristotle came to regard a kind of righteous anger as a virtue. And so we have that in us too. Although I guess he kind of parsed it out like, you should be somewhat angry, but not too angry, and the rational person has this kind of middle ground between what Dale translated as being irascible or non-irascible. So being irascible is you're just a hair trigger hothead, right? And that's no good. But being non-irascible is not good either. That's passive and unresponsive and not sort of showing up. So it might be the great opportunity that we're unfolding, you know, slowly, starting to over our 20 or 30 years and to continue for the next millennia, is how can these sort of deep thoughts come together in a way that's really wholesome and helpful. This Buddhist thought of non-self, of deeply merging and connecting, of letting go of everything, of being willing to give up even our body for the benefit of others, even if the others seem to be like really poorly intentioned and confused, you know. Like, you know, surely in that passage I read, the Bodhisattva could have said, you know, excuse me, I would prefer it if you didn't take my body because I need it for practice. But if you need to, that's okay. But no, it doesn't say that, you know. The robber shows up and says, I'm going to kill you. You say, thank you very much. Go ahead. Can we sort of merge and grow together that with Aristotle's righteous anger at injustice and things that need correcting and need changing? And maybe I'll just close with another contemporary Zen story. This from the wonderful book, The Hidden Lamp, which maybe you studied here. Collection of Zen stories about women Zen teachers. Crying in despair, an earnest student asked her teacher, Seisho Meili Scott, I've worked so hard to transform this crippling loneliness. I can't shake it. I can't live with it. Can you please help me? Holding the student in a steady gaze and offering her confident smile, Meili ended the conversation saying, please do not ever think anything is out of place. I've worked so hard to transform this crippling loneliness. I can't be patient with this loneliness anymore. I can't shake it. I can't live with it. I can't be with this. So I don't know if it's loneliness for you, but it's something, right? Something. Meili replied, please do not ever think anything is out of place. So this world offers itself, you know, to our imagination exactly as it is. Patience beyond patience, tolerance beyond tolerance. Can our practice support us in jumping out of the storyline, feeling the hook, having some wisdom about whether we should cut the line or yank the hook out or just go ahead and tug and feel the water. So I get to hang around for tea. I hope that you get to hang around too, and it'd be interesting to hear your reflections on all this over a cup of tea. What is patience really? How can we really be in this world in a way that's fill it in blank? What is it for you? Thank you.